You're listening to Vatican Radio. Building walls and banning immigrants means deporting the heart of America and letting the politics of fear rule. That's the view of American theologian and author Father Dan Grudy, who heads a Center for Latino Spirituality and Culture at Notre Dame University in Indiana. After spending time running retreat programs for immigrants on the U.S.-Mexico border, Father Dan has been developing a theology of migration, challenging Christians to view themselves as migrants and Jesus as an illegal immigrant who put Mary outside of the law. I sat down with Father Dan to hear how new US legislation will affect his country's immigrant communities and how global migration can be viewed from a theological perspective.
So I lived in Latin America on and off in Uruguay and Argentina during the dictatorship, as well as in Chile. And so that actually galvanized a lot of interest in Latino issues. So when I was ordained, I wanted to stay in Latino ministry, and I also had a strong interest in spirituality. So I started asking really more questions about the spirituality of Latinos in the United States. And the more I got into that issue, the more it got me into the issue of immigration. And so initially they were separate issues, but they began to speak to each other. And so that's where I began to think about theological connections to migration.
What did you see when you were down there looking and living in that area around there?
We were actually working in migrant camps in Southern California at one point, and the life of the community, the faith of the community, the vibrancy of the community was kind of unparalleled to me. And I wanted to know what helped bring that community alive. And so I was part of a program there called the Valley Missionary Program. And it was a retreat program for migrants. And it really kind of deepened in them a sense of faith and mission. But they were also 98% immigrants. And so they actually would bring me back down to their home countries in Mexico. And then they were so interested in this that they had risked even in deportation and arrest in order to bring this message down to people in their home communities. So I was very inspired by it, you know, in terms of the life of the people, the joy of the people, the generosity of the people. But, you know, deep down, they're also golpeado, as they say in Spanish. They were also kind of suffering quite a bit. Not only were they poor, but many were dying in the deserts. Many were struggling for a dignified life. And so all of this was speaking to me and saying, you know, God, Christ, the gospel is very much connected to all this. And so really it began in Latin America. But then since then, it's kind of my interests have gone to other areas where migrants and refugees are, say in Syria, the Syrian border, and as well as in Africa and the genocide of Rwanda. So really migration is a global issue right now, and the church is involved in this globally. And so really as a theologian, I'm just trying to ask, how do we think about this from a faith perspective?
The area that you had this experience in, that Mexico-U.S. border, of course, is very much back in the news again today.
Yes.
With the order by the Trump administration to continue the building of the wall along there. What kind of effect do you think that is going to have on the communities that you saw living right close to the border there?
The poor are really going to feel the brunt of this, and the wall solves nothing. Unless we deal with issues of human security outside our borders, we're never going to have national security inside our borders. And so building walls really does nothing. It closes us off. And in fact, it's deporting the heart, frankly, of America. And it's really taking the values that are key to who we are. And it's actually letting the politics of fear rule us. But the people at the bottom are the ones who suffer the most. And, you know, it's dividing families. And it's actually, for them, they live in a great deal of anxiety as a result of this.
There are already hundreds of miles of wall, aren't there,
right,
or other forms of barriers?
Plus, close to 800 miles.
What difference is this latest piece of legislation going to make?
It's going to make no difference at all because there are natural borders as well. There are mountains and there are deserts. What it's going to mean is people who do want to come are going to take greater risks. So that means more people are going to die. And even if you're a seal off the whole border, you know, you might as well just buy boat building stock, you know, I mean, because people are just going to come in boats. So, or they're going to find a 19-foot ladder to come over an 18-foot wall. So it's really not going to solve it. It's just kind of political bravado that's trying to sound tough and try to seal up the border. If anything, it's going to put a target on our back. Now that we've offended the Mexicans and the Muslims and the Jews and other people, it basically is just saying America's all of our worst fears realized. And so it actually is going to have more people want to harm us rather than really globalizing a solidarity, as John Paul II would say, really trying to learn what it means to be neighbor. and learn what it means to really look beyond our borders. I mean, what good is it? What profit is this if we only think about ourselves? That's as true on a national scale as it is on a personal scale.
Within this first week of the new administration, we've seen unprecedented mobilization protesting against exactly these kind of moves and calling for the globalization of solidarity, including from church communities. What difference do you think does their voice make to this whole protest movement?
Well, I think it's a deep sense of hope. I think it's really kind of helping us go to a deeper river and really claim what's really most important to us. I think for a while we've been staid and lazy and really rather complacent. But I think, you know, as you tap the nerves and as these injustices kind of expose an arrogance and really a style of leadership, it's sort of power without authority, if you will. He may have power, but really effectively there's no real authority, because authority really means that people, and in this case, majority of people, would follow what he's doing. So if this was really something that was compelling and deeply connecting to people on the most fundamental level of our existence, I think there would be real authority there. But because it is so divisive, to me, raises so many questions about real authority.
He was elected, though, on these promises, wasn't he?
He was, but not by the popular vote, and this is disputed and all that. So there is some. There's certainly a following there. But that's just to get elected. The real authority is going to come in what he does. And right now, his polls are diminishing. Not that that's the last word, but I mean, I'm talking about the authority that compels by virtue of goodness, not by fear. And in this case, I'm yet to see it.
Many Catholics, though, are delighted at his move to stop funding for abortion abroad and see him as their candidate. What do you say to Catholics who also, for example, agree that this immigration ban is in the name of national security?
You know, let's give credit where credit can potentially be due. So this is a movement in the right direction in terms of the abortion issue. But as we know, the ethic of life is a broad issue, and it doesn't just include the issues of abortion. It also includes issues of poverty, inequality, issues of migration, and many others. So in terms of the broad-based ethic of life, it really raises a lot of questions. So I'm yet to see that done. But at the other hand, you know, Michael Pence was at the rally in Washington last week, really trying to promote this ethic of life in terms of trying to overturn some of these longstanding issues. It's been a fight of the church for a long period of time. So I'd say that issue, you know, I give him credit for. But, you know, on the other hand, let's see how deep it goes. Let's see also how broad it goes.
What do you think is the most effective way on this migration issue of standing up and making your voice heard?
This is the million-dollar question. There are a number of different ways. I'd say three primary ways: direct service, legislative advocacy, which in this case is trying to protest and really change the policies we have. A big area where I work is the area of education. And so for me, it's changing the minds and also the operative imagination that people have about migrants. The central question is, who is the other and what is my responsibility to the other? And as a theologian, one of the things I try to do is try to reframe that, because that's really at the heart of this. So, I mean, policy is only a later, if you will, consequence of what those operative imaginations are. But to speak theologically for a moment, if we see the incarnation, if we see Jesus himself coming to the human race, coming to this sinful and broken territory, really as the great migration, if we see Jesus himself as a migrant, not just that they fled to Egypt, but also that he became human and went into the otherness of human skin as the divine spirit, that actually challenges us on a very deep level. And on some level, I maintain that scripturally, he was illegal from the beginning. He was illegal from the beginning because when the Annunciation happened, Mary was betrothed to Joseph. And to be found pregnant by somebody other than your espoused other would have put Mary outside the law. So we might ask the question, why would God choose that time to, if you will, migrate into Mary's womb and become human? I mean, why would he be conceived at that moment? Couldn't you have done it more legally in a way that the Pharisees might have found more palatable? Or might it have been really the beginning of the good news, that God opened up a space for hope for all those outside the law, even for those who are considered illegal? There's immense kind of reflection there that we can do in terms of understanding what legality and illegality is like.
It's extremely challenging for many people and very uncomfortable.
Well, you know, it's a deepening reflection of what the gospel message is all about. And I think that one of the things that Jesus did was really to invite everybody to table. That was where he did his ministry. And interestingly enough, he crossed over kind of established boundaries that were set at table. Who belonged, who didn't, who was welcome, who wasn't, who was part of the club and who was not. And so, but he did it out of human concern and a desire to reconcile people. and to bring them to God once again. And so I think we have to see this boundless love that's trying to make this happen. And so really, sometimes issues of legality don't go deep enough. We have to look at it in light of the law of love, not just the law of the current policy. So I think there's a lot there to reflect on. And I think that Jesus himself is really the one we're trying to get our kind of deepest light and our brightest light from.
This idea of migration is very much at the heart of what Pope Francis has been trying to say over the last 3 or 4 years, isn't it, as well? You're going to work, aren't you, quite closely with the Vatican on maybe these issues.
You know, Pope Francis has been amazing on this, and I think it's really rather striking that the first pastoral visit he made outside of the Vatican was to Lampedusa. And so I was very struck because he used a chalice that was made from the remains of a refugee boat. And I went down to Lampedusa to talk to this carpenter and actually to get to reflect with him and say, why was it that you made this chalice? And apparently he gave the Pope 4 chalices to choose from, and he was reluctant to give up this chalice that the Pope used. So this chalice actually is made from a boat where there was a shipwreck, and most of the people were saved, so it was a symbol of salvation. But some of them on the boat died, so it was a symbol of death at the same time. So this wood that this chalice was made from was a symbol of death and salvation. And so really it is a cup of suffering that holds the migrant's pain and agony. But it's a cup of salvation as well, because through it God plunges, if you will, into the suffering of our world, and there opens up a space of hope to bring us back to our homeland. So again, if you see Jesus as entering into our territory as the divine migrant and then calling us back to himself as migrants to the eternal kingdom, then we can situate this migration reality within a larger phenomenon of our call to God, our journey with God. So it's not like there's them who are migrating, there's us who are kind of, you know, stable or whatever, seated. It's actually we're all migrants in this world. So that actually should get us to pause at least to say, who are they and whom I? And if it's true, then we see in the migrant a mirror of ourselves. And if that's the case, then, you know, we need to get to work and help each other along this road of migration. But the Vatican and Pope Francis have been amazing on this.
His gestures have spoken almost louder than his words in many senses since this whole crisis began as well. And yet it doesn't seem to have a huge amount of effect on the people, the policymakers, those in authority. What else can the church be doing, do you think?
I think it's important to understand success-failure logic is not our final logic. It's actually cross-resurrection logic. And I think that, you know, in this sense, we have to keep doing what's right, what we think is right, regardless. It's unfortunate that we don't see much change going on in policies with migration right now. And right now, if anything, they seem to be getting worse than they were. But we have to keep trying to do what's right. We have to keep doing what we know God is calling us to do, and that is to speak in favor of life, to speak in favor of those who are vulnerable, to really open a space, especially those who are persecuted. And once you see these places, I mean, once you talk to the people who are undergoing this, under this duress, it claims you on some level. I mean, so I didn't go out there looking for migration. I didn't go look for a topic to do research on as some academic or something. I fell in love with the people. And once I got in touch with their suffering, that made a claim on me. And everything followed from that.
We've seen some incredibly powerful images, for example, of women braiding their hair together on both sides of that border there in America. Do you think images in a way like that can speak louder than any theology, any words?
Absolutely. And one of the ones, I mean, my main book that I'm working on right now is on migration and Eucharist. And both Pope Francis going down to Lampedusa, but also at the U.S. border each year, there is a binational liturgy, and the bishops from both sides gather together and they have a mass in the beginning of November, and they join the altar together on both sides of the fence. And so it really is quite a spiritual statement, which has political implications, right, which is different than politicizing the liturgy. It's very much a strong spiritual statement, because it's saying that even though these walls are here, we do profess our faith in Christ, and we do profess that we are one body regardless of our nationality. So identities are necessary, and I think it's important that I'm not against borders. I'm not against, you know, boundaries that are set up, because they do help develop culture, they do help protect people, they do make a space for people to thrive as a community. But when borders become barriers, this is when this alienation happens. And the irony is it makes us aliens to ourselves. So while we disconnect ourselves from our neighbor in need, we become alien. We become alien to who we're called to be as human beings made in God's image and likeness. That's the irony about it. And as one theologian said, Lidio Tomasi, I loved his line. He says, you know, working with migrants and seeing their faith. And I would say seeing their faith and their capacity to believe amidst the most unbelievable, and to really trust in God amidst the most godless of circumstances. It's not that the church saves the immigrant. It's the immigrant who saves the church.
My thanks to Father Dan Grudy, head of the Center for Latino Spirituality and Culture at Notre Dame University.